Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We've had another noteworthy review this week. Spudders LFC writes, unsufferable host with an insufferable voice, which surprised him because I don't think anyone knew that I was going to be filling in for Yaz. But as a reminder, you are allowed to slander us in basically whatever way you see fit, as long as it accompanies a five-star review. So go wild. There's lots to get through this week, as well as the Commonwealth Games, the start of the 100, Richard Thompson's appointment as ECB chair and all the other happenings in the World Game. We'll also take some time to look back in depth at South Africa's 2003 Test Series draw in England, a series which saw the end of the Hussein era and the start of Vaughan's reign, breakout performances from Graham Smith and Andrew Flintoff, and the final Test century of a certain Mark Butcher, who joins us in person today. Mark, how's it going?
Yeah, very good. Lovely to be back. Centre Parks was a welcome break, but I'm now fit and raring to go.
That's good. Rested and rotated and backfiring. We've also got Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine editor Joe Harmon, who wrote an excellent feature on that very series in the new issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly out this week, and Taha Hashim, who was 6 years old when that series took place.
Oh, jeez.
Hello, Taha. Hello, Joe. Let's start at Edgbaston, where New Zealand beat England to Commonwealth Games bronze, and Australia, no surprises there, claimed gold ahead of India. We'll get to the cricket itself in a second, but in a way, the most remarkable thing about it was Talia McGrath's participation in the final. She tested positive for COVID-19 and had low-level symptoms, but was still allowed to play. She sat masked up away from her teammates while Australia were batting and waved her teammates away from celebrating with her after taking the catch of Shefali Verma in the field. But it's remarkable how quickly the world has moved on, given that it's only 8 months ago that Pat Cummins missed an Ashes test just for being a close contact for someone with COVID. And now we've got a player who is literally COVID positive, just playing as normal, essentially.
Yeah, well, you wonder how long that might have been going on anyway, don't you, in some certain... In some of the places that I've been, when the testing was, you still had to sort of test negative or whatever. They basically put the testing stick in your general vicinity and then walked off and said you were fine. So you wonder how long that is actually been going on, but obviously not officially. Players having COVID and being out there on the park. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? The vaccines have changed a lot for the better in terms of people being able to go about their daily lives in a relatively normal way. There was something I saw on Twitter yesterday, and of course you have to be a little bit careful. I didn't sort of check the veracity of it, but they're saying that in Australia the sort of like the third highest cause of death now is COVID over there in Australia itself. Of course they were very heavily locked down for a long, long period of time, weren't they? But they don't seem to be entirely on top of things over there at the moment since coming out of it. So yeah, I mean, interesting. As interesting as India losing another final, maybe not, but it's worth talking about.
Yeah, well, there has been a bit of sort of backlash to that decision, but I can't really tell if it is just the sort of changing world and something we are going to have to get used to, basically.
Harmanpreet, India's captain, seemed fine with it, really. I mean, she said she didn't want to see McGrath pulled out at the last minute. I think if the opposition kick up a stink, then there's going to be an issue. But I think there is an understanding, potentially based on what Butch is saying, that, you know, this might be one where you've got a positive, but this kind of thing has probably been happening quite a lot, perhaps. So to drag someone out of a big final at the last minute would have seemed perhaps a bit unfair and churlish, given that people are wandering around the country with COVID day in, day out at the moment, and that's within the rules. So
yeah, well, I mean, I think the other part of it is the fact that it was a final, I guess. Not that it's, you know, it's such a big game that you should, you know, you should be able to sort of flaunt whatever rules might be in place, and I'm not saying that's what they did. But I wonder if they might have taken a slightly different view if it had been one of the games earlier on, because then, of course, you then run the risk of lots more people contracting it and then having a problem with people being in the squad. So the fact that there wasn't anything to do beyond the final probably led to the decision being taken. It was a pretty pragmatic one. And you're right, if the opposition don't mind, then you crack on.
I mean, McGrath herself had a pretty poor game, having had a pretty...
Not surprised, she wasn't feeling very well.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing, but it's not just that, but also, like, I imagine that while you're playing this huge game in your career, you're also just constantly thinking about the fact that COVID, I can't go near my teammates, like, you know. Like,
she was ushering them away at one point, wasn't she?
I think, yeah, exactly.
Did she take a catch and they came to sort yeah, of exactly. circle her and she yeah. kind of yeah. sent everyone away? So that's it's an odd thing to have in the back of your mind when you're taking a catch, that you can't let anyone near you afterwards.
So almost I can't really even sort of envisage like anyone having a really good game, like being able to put aside one the illness, but also just like the constant thinking about it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's a really good point. I mean, it's probably not a great pick, yeah. is what you're saying. Yeah.
And also that thing about, like, you know, they win and she's kind of like, has to still keep her distance and that kind of thing. It's just like, just bizarre. I remember when I saw the sort of news flash up that she was playing, I mean, tested, I was just like, what is this? This is ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I had to pull out of the test match, the Lord's test for the first one against New Zealand. Like, my wife and daughter tested positive on the Wednesday morning. I popped in, I came home from another game, popped in, grabbed my stuff and left. And then by the time, you know, so I had to tell them that I'd been in contact with people. They wanted a clear test. I got one that evening, but then the next morning I woke up feeling dreadful. And so I thought, well, I've probably got it. And lo and behold, that night I tested positive. And so from a work point of view, we would need two negative lateral flow tests before they let us come back to work. So different organisations obviously have different ways of dealing with it.
And I guess you're sitting in an enclosed box with these people. So if you've got it, everyone's going to get it.
Yeah, with lit mics and various other stuff. So yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you sort of touched on it, Taha, that it almost shows how keen Australia were to include her. It's how important McGrath's become so quickly. And although Australia won, which is what we'd all expected, this was a close game. India needed 17 off the last two overs. They had 4 weeks in hand and then sort of collapsed at the end. I don't know, was this Australia being beatable and just squeezing over the line, or was this Australia knowing how to get it done when it kind of came down to it, do you think, Joe?
I think in those scenarios, I pretty much always think Australia are going to get over the line and that they've got things under control, even when, to all intents and purposes, they don't seem to. And it was similar to the first game of the tournament as well, which was a game that Australia shouldn't have really won. But still, you look at the depth of their side, just that they've always got the quality to come good, particularly in big games. And there is that thing now where India have lost a lot of finals and they've got that mental hurdle to overcome as well. But I think it was a good, I think in general, it was a good tournament. I think it was, from the bits I saw, it was a good advert for the game, that horrible cliche. But I think it was, and actually, I mean, Taha said before, this India getting to the final, I think is good for the game as well, if we want to expand it beyond its kind of traditional boundaries. England will be disappointed, but I think we're going to come onto that.
Yeah, well, let's do it now. I mean, they came fourth. They lost a close game by 4 runs to India in the semi-final and then were thumped by New Zealand. I wonder if they had almost more of a hangover than New Zealand. New Zealand go into a semi with Australia and think, well, we're probably, you know, we're going to need to do something really good to win here, so you're not so disappointed, whereas England come so close and then end up playing the match they don't want to play in. But you actually were more disappointed by their semi-final performance, Joe.
Yeah, I found it frustrating to watch that they didn't bowl particularly well. Certainly up top, they bowled poorly. Then they pulled it back and were left with a chaseable target of, what, 160 pretty much. Yeah, 160 odd. And they got off to a bit of a flyer. So Sophia Dunkley scored a quick 20 and then Danny White continued it. And they were in a really, really strong position. And then it was a Siver and Amy Jones partnership for quite a long period of the game, the middle overs. And I just thought they, again, another awful cliche, lacked intent, but they were really, both of them were playing the same role, which was to knock it around. Siver was struggling uncharacteristically. I could see she needs to just stay in there and hope that fluency comes. But I thought Amy Jones should have gone out harder. She was going at pretty much a runner ball. And the run rate, required run rate, kept creeping up. And I thought it was just a poorly judged chase in the end. And it felt almost inevitable that they were going to come up short because they just left themselves too much to do. And I thought it was naive, particularly when it was almost like they were playing, thinking that they had the tail that they used to have, where England have struggled for lower order hitters beyond Brunt. But Eccleston gives it a whack.
I mean, she hit the last ball of the game for six, didn't she?
Exactly. And there you think, well, I thought she should have come in. I thought she should have come in when Bouchier came on anyway. But they shouldn't have really been chasing that required run rate. It should have been much more manageable than it was. And I think they'll be kicking themselves looking back on that. Not New Zealand was different. They just played very poorly against India. I think it was a poor kind of game management. I don't know how much of that is to do with Heather Knight not being part of the group, not having a skipper there probably doesn't help. Or whether Siver maybe tightened up a little bit with the bat because she has so much responsibility on her shoulders as captain. But it was not the Siver knock that we've come to expect over the last couple of years, which, you know, it's fair enough. She can't play brilliantly every time. But if she doesn't, then she needs a bit more support around her, I think.
Mm. Tahar, you were impressed by some of the newer faces in the England camp.
Yeah, I mean, kind of the expectation was that England should be at least getting to the final and then at the very least getting a bronze medal, which sounds weird. But I mean, I still found it quite exciting watching them throughout the tournament just because there are just some newer faces in there. Capsy's brilliant. We saw it kind of last year in the 100, but then obviously to then still come into an England team and the way she's played, you know, going down the track to Shabnam Ismail in that game against South Africa and getting a half century, and just some of her shots through the offside were brilliant. Freya Kemp came in and was kind of like the final, like, box ticked in an attack which had, you know, pretty decent pace, right arm pace, left arm pace, spin, a leg spinner, a left arm spinner, an offie as well. And yeah, I mean, it's funny because like Joe's saying, there was kind of a conservatism to England in that game against India. And you say, you know, not sending Eccleston up and the way Siver and Jones batted. But then part of this England side has also been, you know, having Dunkley open the batting as well, just trying to be a bit more aggressive, dropping Beaumont for this tournament. There were kind of signs there that they were going to kind of push through and with these newer faces have kind of a newer style of play as well. So it's, in the end, it'll be kind of like a one to look back on as a maybe good in the long term type of thing. Yeah. If you're going to put a positive spin on it, basically.
Yeah, well, just before we started recording, the news broke that Lisa Kightley is stepping down as England head coach at the end of the summer. That decision was reached before the Commonwealth Games, according to the ECB, and the statement reads that both parties agreed the time was right to ensure the next head coach has time to work with the squad in the lead up to the next Women's T20 World Cup. Under her, England reached the semi-finals of the T20 World Cup, the final of the ODI World Cup, did okay in the Ashes, obviously that brilliant test match, and we'll have more on her reign and England's search for a successor next week. But Butch, it's that. The expanding of England's player pool and those young players that have been brought in when for so long England's team was quite a closed shop, will that be the Kightley legacy, I guess, if such a thing exists?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, anytime you come in off the back of great success, and anytime you have a squad that is getting a little bit older, a little bit more experienced, the likelihood that you continue to sort of dominate, or at least dominate outside of Australia, and that transition continues without any bumps in the road is pretty unlikely. And yet, in the midst of all of that, they've managed to sort of ease out some of the old faces. Obviously, Anya Shrubsole retiring is one of the big ones. Catherine Brunt now, she's still going to play white ball, right? She's not made any announcements.
No.
She was non-committal when she was asked.
Right, okay. I mean, so you know, they had big potentially very big shoes to fill, and I think they've gone a long way towards doing that. So they managed to keep their competitive edge and still be a good side. You know, they should have won that semi-final, and I wonder just how much in the women's game still that chasing, particularly when the stakes become very high, becomes, you know, is more difficult than perhaps it might be in the men's game. And that's, you know, that's understandable. It was years. It was a long, long time before people chased down targets on a regular basis in men's 50 and 20 over cricket. You know, that sort of transition took a long time for people to be able to sort of judge run chases, be able to take more risks when the scoreboard pressure was there. So, you know, that it's understandable. We've seen India do it on many occasions now, and it's, you know, England winning that World Cup in 2017 was defending, wasn't it? You know, a game they probably should have lost. The team in the field somehow has the whip hand, you feel, in big games in women's cricket. So look, I think it's been an excellent job, and she hands it over to whoever comes in next with young players who've got experience behind them now. They're not all starting as debutants, or won't be starting as debutants at some point in the lead up to the next World Cup in 2023. They've all got game time. They're all now part of an integrated squad. They don't sort of walk in and look at Nat Siver and Heather Knight and think, oh my God, you know. These are sort of big, scary beasts in the side. They've played with them. They're in the dressing room, and it can only augur well going forward. So I think she's done a pretty good job.
Yeah, and just on the pressure point, people were talking after the India defeat about how this showed the need for a women's IPL. Obviously, because Australia have that massive player pool that's come from the Big Bash, but they've also just played so many more games that matter and that have quite a lot riding on them, that are in front of big crowds with big platforms, and that kind of shows as well. It's as much the quality of their players, but also the fact they'll have been in those kind of situations before in a way that other ties sometimes haven't at those big stages.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just the growth of the game, isn't it? The more there is, the more sort of platforms there are, the more that the women's game kind of grows, you'll end up, as a matter of course, having more eyeballs and more sort of meaningful contests, I suppose. And so it's not a necessity. It's kind of like, we don't need to do this because India and other teams are losing. It's just that this is going to be the natural progression of how it goes. And you will end up then, with any luck, having, you know, not having Australia be such standout favourites for every tournament you go into. But, we're probably about 3 or 4 years away from that yet.
Yeah. Well, so as you said, Joe, good tournament from a neutral perspective. There were 17,000 in for the final, which was only 3,000 short of capacity. Edgbaston was reduced capacity for some reason. Raf Nicholson tweeted that was a record for neutral women's international in England, and that would be a few years ago. That would have been an impressive figure even for an England women's game, and you know, even for the 100, that would have been something they'd have dreamed of at the start of last year. And there came this week the news that cricket has been added to a shortlist of 9 sports for review ahead of the 2028 Olympic Games, which will be held in LA. At a time when international cricket needs all the oxygen it can get, that would be hugely welcome, wouldn't it, Taha, if cricket were finally to be in that multi-sport event?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't really see the downside to it.
the schedule would be the only one.
Yeah, but...
Like, and I'm not saying that is significant enough to be put into the mix, but that, I mean, there is a lot of cricket around, and that would be more.
I think historically that was kind of the ECB's reluctance towards the Olympics. I think Giles Clark was, you know, he was like, well, it's going to eat into our summer, we'll lose a lot of money. But you can also kind of understand now this growing argument where, I mean, I guess I'm just seeing it from an England point of view and from not other teams, but you could have a team playing in the Olympics in a shorter form, and I guess you could still have Test cricket here, right? That's kind of a thing that could happen, especially in, you know, 6 years down the line. Yeah. We're kind of seeing the game go towards that direction anyway.
I mean, I suppose I have an aversion to the idea in the same way that I did when the Dream Team played. You know, I know the Olympic ideal is not quite what it used to be in terms of amateur sports people, etc. And I know those days are long gone, but I still find the idea of professional paid sports people in an Olympic Games, which is the showcase for sports that do not have year round spotlights, you know, seasons that come in and out every single year. And I understand it from the point of view of trying to grow the game beyond the eyes of other people. But given the congestion that there is, and given that there is so little room for anything else, you would imagine. Adding some yet another competition, another player drain into something which traditionally I don't think cricket belongs is, you know, I'm willing to have somebody come and tell me I'm talking nonsense, but it just doesn't feel, it doesn't feel like something that I'd be massively excited about, put it that way.
No, and I guess there's an element that is sort of, as England-centric cricket supporters, maybe it's just, it's not really for us. It's not a, it's about exposure for other nations. It's about, you know, giving more opportunities for teams to play cricket on a big stage. And for GB, it would be, that doesn't really matter particularly, because there are bigger fish to fry. But in terms of the global game, I think it's a, I'm for it in that step. But I think that there is a risk for us as cricket fans that it falls a bit flat. Like, I mean, Olympic football or soccer has never had any interest for me whatsoever, and I'm a massive football fan. And cricket might feel a bit like that for us as well when it's on at the Olympics, but hopefully it doesn't feel like that for loads of other people who are potentially coming to the game for the first time, or other emerging nations get a chance to play it on a bigger stage.
I don't know. There's always this inherent conservatism for cricket to kind of do something different. You know, we've felt it for the last few years with the 100. I'm not trying to equate those two arguments, but like, what's the worst that's going to happen from it?
Elsewhere, the ECB's long search for a chair has finally come to an end, with it announced that Richard Thompson, currently the chair at Surrey, will take up the role from the beginning of September. Joe, what can we expect from him?
I don't know if I can answer that, to be honest. I don't... Well, okay, so he did an interview with the Cricketer in 2018 when he had just resigned from the ECB board. He was unhappy that decisions were being made that he wasn't being consulted on or even aware of. I think this is particularly the Colin Graves era, where he was sort of his own man. And, you know, one example was launching a lawsuit against ESPN, which Richard Thompson only heard about in the press. And I don't think he wanted to be affiliated with some of those things. So he stood down. But in that interview, it's always interesting going back to what people say before they get roles that they probably didn't expect to get, Rob Key being a good recent example. But Richard Thompson talked about Red Bull cricket being the gold standard, Championship cricket being the gold standard, said that's where legacies are left and careers are made. And he continued, there's got to be a real sense that we can't allow Red Bull cricket to become diminished any further or devalued anymore. So, you know, those are strong words I think most of us in this room agree with, a lot of traditional cricket fans agree with. The question is, when you're in that position, what can you do effectively to make sure that belief is followed? And that'll be really interesting to see if he can continue to do that. Another interesting element is Surrey voted against the 100, have not been vociferous in support of it since. Now you've got the Surrey chairman in that, former Surrey chairman in that position at the ECB. Look, anyone who thinks the 100 is going to disappear as a result of this, sorry folks, that's not happening. But it will be interesting to see that, how that tension, potential tension develops, given that the club he represented previously were not on board with this as a project and didn't really see the value in it, albeit as a rich club that didn't necessarily need it in the way that some other counties might have benefited from its support, financially at least.
Well, I suppose that would be an interesting thing, in that when he was in charge of Surrey, that was obviously, that might well have been what he believed from a principal point of view as well, but it made sense from a business point of view for Surrey, because they were one of the counties who could sort of support themselves and didn't need this cash injection. So if they had something that they felt was going to diminish their standing as, you know, the Oval side, that would be something they would be against from a, you know, even though it might have also had magnanimous intentions from a self-interested point of view as well. But you know him quite well. Yeah. What sort of personality is it going to be, rubbing people up the wrong way like Graves and Clark? Or
he,
all right?
He doesn't suffer fools, that is for sure. And he will stand his corner on things that he believes strongly in. I mean, Tomo was a very successful businessman before he had his first go at being chairman of Surrey. So he was chairman for that period where Surrey County Cricket Club started to win championships and to build that. To build that sort of fantastic team around the turn of the century. He then, you know, walked away and went off and pursued other interests and then sort of saw the way that things were going here at the club, didn't like what he saw and decided to come back again. So he's kind of got that perspective of somebody that's been in the job, has then gone off and pursued other business interests, but then come back to it simply out of the love for the club and the love for the game. You know, I was in on some of the meetings with, because I was a Surrey general committee member, and I was in with some of the meetings with the ECB when it was getting very, very fractious, because, you know, clearly having not having one of the big counties, one of the big grounds on board with 100 was a big problem for the ECB. And Richard very much stood his corner and very much spoke up for the other counties. You know, he understood that the position that Surrey is and was in then was very different from a lot of the others, and was very keen to sort of point out, yeah, okay, I mean, you know, for us, we kind of, you know, we feel as though we put on T20 tournaments and T20 matches as well as anything, and nothing that you can do with a team that is not Surrey is going to be any better than what we do here already. So from our point of view, you know, you need to sell it a little bit better. And from everybody else's point of view, there is a danger that they're kind of signing their death warrant with it. And he was very keen to kind of try and point that out. And that was the reason why Surrey took the stand that they did. You know, and as it's turned out, that there was no stopping the 100. But I think it's an important sort of marker for somebody like him to lay down, in terms of having the other 17 chairmen sort of look at him and go, okay, well, this guy was willing to stick his neck out for us on an issue as big as this, even when Surrey County Cricket Club didn't need to and didn't have to. So that's the kind of guy you're dealing with. You know, on a personal level, you know, terrific fun, great fella to be around. Very, very sociable, very sort of willing to mix and to talk to various people. But you get on the wrong side of him, you're in serious trouble. So, you know, that's what you got. And it, you know, it's I think it's really interesting to have somebody with his background and his time in the game and his time in the sport taking over at this, which feels like a really pivotal moment in the game in this country. And wider than that, you know, with the UAE League and the problems that Australia are now finding with their players for the Big Bash and the proliferation of franchise tournaments around the world, all of this type of stuff.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle, a run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
It's going to need a strong lead, and I think he's that.
Well, ahead of the Test series, which starts next week, the South Africa are playing against the Lions side at Canterbury. Often Lions squads are not too interesting, but given this is the first Red Bull Lions squad of the McCullum era and the Test squads have been very similar so far, I think there maybe is a little bit to be read into them, possibly. So just quickly, Sam Billington as captain, Brooke Robinson, Overton, you'll expect to be there, being on the fringe of the Test side. Sam Cook's in there as well. Liam Paterson White and Will Jacks, the two spin options, which I guess is notable considering the Pakistan series later this year. And then Sam Connors, who's a tall Derbyshire quick, and James Roo, an 18-year-old Somerset keeper who made his maiden first-class 100 recently, are the two most unknown faces. But for me, it's the batters in there. So Keaton Jennings, Dom Sibley, Dan Lawrence and Ben Duckett that tell us the most about England plans, that maybe they're not afraid to go back to people. And especially, I guess especially Sibley, Butch. I mean, you know, Lawrence and Duckett fit the McCullum mantra fairly well, but Sibley's about as far from that template as you can get. And the fact that he is in this effectively second string England side is perhaps notable.
Yeah, I think so. But I also believe that players are not beholden to one way of being able to play. Now, Dom will have looked at what's gone on and thought to himself, well, if I want to get back to play Test match cricket again, I've got to expand my game. In fact, he knew that anyway. That was part of the reason he was left out in the first place. But now, obviously, seeing the direction of travel, you know, in order to be a... If you're a smart man, you've kind of thought to yourself, okay, well, I'm going to need to adjust my game and perhaps my thinking in terms of if I want to get back up there again. Keaton Jennings is another example, somebody that's kind of... He's had a decent season, hasn't he? There have been a few guys who have made runs, who have had a go before. I definitely think that that's an advantage for players to have experienced Test match cricket and failed. It certainly shouldn't rule you out of getting another go at it at some point down the line. But at the moment, the door appears to be shut. I mean, other names on there. I mean, Dan Lawrence is interesting because he's found his moment has kind of come and gone, hasn't it? For the moment, anyhow, you know, Johnny Bairstow has now just nailed the door shut on a number five berth. Joe Root's back at number four, so you're not getting in there. You know, six, you're not getting in. The captain's batting there, so you've got number three or opening. That's where you're looking. I like the fact that we have these games that the guys get a chance to go and play long form cricket in an environment that is not their own against high class opposition.
Mm. On Jennings Taha, you spoke to him for WCM. Did you get the sense this is a player sort of ready for another go?
Not really, in kind of the way that, obviously, naturally, we talked about his season so far, but obviously we have to talk about England because that's just what you do when someone makes a few runs. But he's someone who just, I guess, has had two pretty solid seasons, actually did quite well last year as well, but no one really talks about him anymore just because of how it went at test level. I mean, he did really struggle, obviously had those 200s in the subcontinent, but otherwise... you know, I think he's reached 50 about three times in 32 innings. But I asked him about his test ambitions, and obviously he was quite, you know, I'd love to play test cricket again. Who wouldn't say that? But he also said he was quite philosophical about the whole thing and just said, where I am with my life, you know, if I don't play test cricket again, I'm as happy as I would be if I did play test cricket again. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, do you actually mean it? But just the way he said it and the way he was kind of just talking about it, I kind of did buy it. He is someone who, I guess, people are still judging him by how he went a few years ago, but he's, you know, he said himself, I'm older. That helps with a lot of things in terms of how you look at the game, but also makes you a better player. He's kind of changed his technique a bit. If you watch him now, he's quite a different player to the one we saw at test level, where he was kind of quite upright, the bat was up high, and he said just a small change I've made is the bat's a lot lower. It basically, you know, hits the ground for you as the bowler's running in. And I guess we kind of fall into the mindset of just looking, oh, here's this guy's test average, you know, forget it, it's not going to happen. But players are allowed to get better, believe it or not. And so, not saying you should play test cricket again, but I'm interested to see how he goes.
He was the name that jumped out for me because he's not... Sibley has sort of recently been dropped and was on the line, was picked for the Lions tour, which he didn't go on quite recently. So he's sort of in that kind of next in line bit. And then they pick young players who they just want to have a look at. There's no reason to go back to Jennings at this point unless you are considering him as a potential test cricketer again. And we've got trip to Pakistan in, what is it, December, the test series out there. He's got a century in Gaul. He's got a century in Mumbai. If Crawley has failed throughout the South Africa series, which on recent form is perfectly possible, do they get to a point eventually where they have to say, well, we can't continue picking him? And if they do get to that point and they're looking for an opener who can play spin well, we talked about Haseeb Hameed a couple of pods ago about being a potential kind of horses for courses selection for those reasons. Jennings is probably above him in that horses for courses idea because he's actually got more recent runs in the subcontinent, and he's had a better year than Hameed. Hameed's had a good year, but Jennings has had a better year and is playing Div 1 cricket.
Yeah, and I guess there's also, I mean, Rob Key said when McCullum was appointed that when asked about the likes of Crawley and Pope, that they sort of needed the right environment to unlock their potential. And if that's true of them, why would that not be true for some of the other players who have been tried and discarded in the past who might now, and why might someone like Jennings not be one of them, I suppose?
One of the things he also said was just how intense he was when he was playing test cricket and how he'd, you know, obviously if he did things again, he would just be a lot more relaxed, and it just kind of sounded like the type of guy who, obviously, I mean, I guess right now, who wouldn't want to play under Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes, but he seems like the type of guy who is kind of that sort of far more chilled out mindset of understanding that it's not, you know, it's not the end of the world if you don't get runs today, and he's kind of got there in his career.
I think I suppose the only caveat to all of this, and particularly with Pakistan in mind, is that you're going to have a couple of new bowlers who bowl rockets as well. So, well, you've got to get to the spinners first.
If you look at what the spinners average in that Australia Pakistan series this year, then actually maybe it's the pace needs to worry about.
But anyway, I mean, I'm good to see him enjoying his cricket and playing well. You know,
The men's 100 has started. I don't know if anyone noticed that. Probably the moment the competition came at Lord's yesterday, when Tottenham Hotspur's Harry Kane and Matt Doherty came out to whack a few balls before play started. Harry Kane also did the toss in a Morgan Stead.
That was actually more interesting than the game itself.
Well, we're only a few games in, so we won't get too deep into the analysis of it. But it's all about enjoyment. So, Tar, have you enjoyed it? Has it grabbed your attention, passed you by?
Well, I've kind of enjoyed one game, which was here. Oval Invincibles versus London Spirit, where Oval Invincibles are like 12-4 or something chasing it, and the game's pretty much dead, and then Danny Briggs, having bowled just 5 balls, suddenly turns it up with a bat, as does Sunil Narine. I think they need 6 off the last ball, and then just fell short, but like, it was, you know, a genuinely great game, good atmosphere as well. But then on the flip side of that, I was at Lord's last night for London Spirit West Manchester Originals, which was properly one-sided, and yeah, not that great. But I mean, the tournament will presumably pick up. It's kind of missed that kind of, obviously the thing about the double headers was also kind of an atmosphere kind of building throughout the day as well. When I left Lord's last night, I was noting how different it was to when I left Lord's last year, where it was like I was at sort of like freshers week at uni, whereas last night was just very calm, you know, not much happening.
And I guess so, when the women's competition starts, you'd also just be more likely to get one of the two games be good. Like, if you have 2 bad games in a row now, it's like, actually that's like kind of 48 hours, a bit more, where the 100 seems like it's sort of a bit of a dud, whereas in when there's 2 games in a day, you have just much more chance of a standout thing happening.
You know what it does? It really highlights how short it is. I mean, I know we've had a couple of issues with games going over time or whatever, but when there's only one game, you really do, you know, and if it isn't any good, it feels like, I just wasted. I didn't say that. Yes, I did. Well, you know, you've just, you know, a couple of hours have gone by, and kind of like you think, okay, is that it? And people trudge off home. It was a bit like that at Cardiff on Sunday. I mean, I suppose, you know, you got used to it last year with it all being double headers, didn't you? So your expectation was that. It hasn't been that. It's not going to be that until what day do we get to the double headers?
Thursday.
Is it Thursday? Yeah. Right. It's Tuesday today. So things will perhaps return to normal. And there was also, you know, again, and I can't reiterate this enough, during the tournament last year, the amount of sort of, you know, 10 to 18-year-old girls who'd come to watch the girls' games, who then stuck around and watched the men's games afterwards, and they'd, you know, there were younger kids with parents and all that kind of stuff. But you did the age groups and the dynamic of who was there watching was very different when there hadn't been the girls' game prior to the men's game. So, you know, it's just interesting to observe how the dynamic is different when the girls' games are on too.
Joe, your moment of the week came from the 100, and actually that game here.
Same game that Tar's already talked about, yes. Actually, but it wasn't really the 100 itself. It was Jason Roy's continued struggles. First ball of Oval Invincibles reply. He guided a fairly innocuous delivery straight into the hands of Mason Crane at a kind of fly slip position, out first ball. Walks off kind of laughing as though he's just like, what have I got to do? Like, how do I get out of this funk? And then 3 days later, he gets 10 off 10 against Welsh Fire and absolutely middles one to short fine leg. So he's finding various ways of getting out. And after a miserable T20 summer for England, we've got the numbers here, 76 runs at an average of 13, strike rate of just 78 is almost more concerning, because it's just, that's not what we know of Jason Roy. Obviously, things are not working for him. Kevin Peterson is rallied to his defence, said he's England's best player and has been for a number of years, which is, you know, KP hyperbole, but he has been a brilliant, more 50 over. His T20 record is not superb, it's good, but it's not exceptional. But we all know what he can do in that format. A fit and firing Jason Roy is in my England side, absolutely. But I don't know how long. I'm thinking ahead to the World Cup here. He needs some runs quite soon, I think, because I'm not saying his career should be over by any means. He's 32. He's got many years ahead of him. But in T20, particularly when you're opening and you've got those power play deliveries, you can't carry someone. You can't have someone soaking up deliveries at that time. And form is so important in T20. So I think dropping someone for a tournament and bringing them back in T20 is kind of acceptable in a way that it might not be in other formats, just because single deliveries matter so much. So Roy, he's got plenty of knocks to go in the 100 to pull himself out of this funk, but I think he needs to do it quite quickly because England aren't short of options. There are lots of players breathing down his neck, and England's T20 side, particularly given they're struggling, they need to be quite ruthless, I think, when they pick their squad. So we'll have to see how he goes, but it's looking tough for him. Butch, I mean, when you see a player out of form like that,
he's having an absolute mare at the minute, and I hadn't been concerned actually until the last T20 game at Southampton, where he just, it was almost like you could see the cogs whirring around in his head. He was kind of thinking, should I hit this? Should I not? And that is where, you know, if you're going out there to trying to take massive risks at the top of the order, you're going to have runs where you don't score any runs. But it was the sudden hesitancy as to whether or not he should try and thump it or not that was a little bit of a concern. Now, the chances are he's going to come out of that between now and the end of the 100. And then you'd be happy enough to pick him. I mean, England's options when they have, you know, when the likes of Stokes is back and they've got a full list to pick from within the guys that you would normally see in England's white ball stuff, you've got options to sort of bring Berso to the top of the order, and you know, you could bat Stokes at number 3, whatever. You could adjust it around the players that you've got already without even bringing somebody else in, and somebody like Phil Salt will probably be, you would imagine, would probably be in the squad anyway. So you know, at the moment, it's not panic stations, but it's a good story, though, isn't it? Because, the struggles, there are struggles and there are struggles at the moment. It's very, very public, and it looks like it's getting worse rather than better at the minute.
Well, that's what it has become, a story. Every time he bats now, it will be a story, and that's the BBC headline now. But I was thinking of his ODI career. I was just looking up his scores because I remembered a kind of similar funk, and I think it was 2017.
The Champions Trophy, yeah.
Yeah, and he really did struggle, and I thought there were similar things. He was getting out in odd ways. His brain looked a bit scrambled, and then he went 84, 96, 180, and 3 knocks. So no, we're not saying that.
I think that's KP's point, isn't it? That it kind of, you know, he might not be scoring any runs at the moment, and it might be looking like the world is ending for him. But then, with somebody with that amount of ability, can suddenly just go flick a switch and everything's fine. So I wouldn't be on the Roy out train just yet.
No, and just to be clear, neither am I yet.
But yeah, I mean, just in terms of other options on the notable performances, James Vince made an unbeaten 71 in Southern Braves opening win, and Will Jackson already mentioned, but he played maybe the innings of the 100, 81 or 45 against Welsh Fire when no other Oval Invincibles player scored it much above a run a ball. And Owen Morgan is back in form as well. He's played 2 Spartan cameos for London Spirit after having had a month doing not very much.
Unbelievable. Having spent the last month with him on all of those England white ball games. And kind of showing very little enthusiasm for getting the pads back on again. And first time out, he smokes it everywhere. Good on him. The Spirit are 2 from 2 as well, which is a massive turnaround from last year.
Already won more games this year than they did in the whole of last season.
Yeah. They were dismal last year, weren't they?
On to county cricket, where the One Day Cup is well underway. The game of the competition so far, again, came at the Oval, unfortunately. We try and not be too Surrey biased, but it's tough when that's how it falls. Surrey burgled a tie, having been 226 for 8, chasing 294 to win against Warwickshire. Nick Kimmer made 84 of 51, and then Matt Dunn smashed 34 of 19 from number 10 before falling with the scores level. 19-year-old Tom Prest has played the innings of the competition without a doubt, hitting 181 for Hampshire against Kent. And there's been some big transfer news in county cricket as well, with Ryan Higgins returning to Middlesex from Gloucestershire. Undoubtedly an excellent signing, although Middlesex fans may well rue the 5 years he spent away from the club, having left because of a dearth of first-team opportunities.
Ollie Robinson might argue he's played the innings of the competition.
That's
so
true,
far.
Yes. Yeah, he played that double 100. I guess I thought of Ollie Robinson as more of an established name, whereas Prest, it was a real, like, a... under-19 star bolt from the blue kind of thing.
Fair enough. I just sense some angry Kent
yes,
fans
that's
ready
true.
To...
Yes, yeah. And I think they'll be irate at the fact that it's been reported in the Evening Standard that Darren Stevens is set to leave the club at the end of the season. Yeah, he might well have already played his last game. He sustained an injury in a one-day cup game, and it looks like he won't recover from that by the end of the season. And there's no word yet on if another county will give him...
Come on, Leicestershire.
Yeah,
where
exactly. The fairy tale return. Taha, your moment of the week is from the one-day cup.
Yeah, it was Worcestershire's Kashif Ali scoring 100 on his List A debut. And his story itself is very fascinating. He spent years playing second team cricket, originally from Pakistan, originally from Kashmir. I think moved over here when he was 12 or something, and has played for so many second team sides. But basically his breakthrough, he landed a Worcestershire short-term contract a couple months ago and then got a long-term deal this month. But his kind of breakthrough has come from being part of the South Asian Cricket Academy, which was basically set up last year. This is their first kind of... They started running through the winter, and this is their first summer. And essentially, it is basically to... You know, the galling statistic that has done the rounds in English cricket the last few years is that players of South Asian heritage make up 30% of the recreational playing base, but that drops to about 5% at professional level. And so the academy has been set up for players who are 18 plus, who have kind of been rejected by the system and is trying to get them into the professional game. So they've been playing games against county second 11 oppositions all summer. They played Worcestershire in April, and Kashif was playing for the South Asian Cricket Academy and scored a half century. From there, he kind of was trialling with Worcestershire, made tons of runs for the twos, and is now, you know, fully fledged within the setup, has made his first class debut, has played this List A game, scored 100, played a few last games as well. So it's just quite an interesting program they've got going, quite revolutionary in a sense. It's kind of similar along the lines of ACE in terms of administrators weren't doing enough, and so people have just decided that we're going to do it, basically. SACA has no funding from the ECB. It's been done. It's been funding's come through Birmingham City University. It's co-founded by Tom Brown, an academic who's done a lot of research in this topic, and Kabir Ali, who obviously played for England. And so it's, yeah, they're kind of basically showing up administrators because they're showing how much talent is out there. They've beaten, in their first summer, they've beaten Northants second 11s. They beat Surrey second 11s. I went to that game a couple months ago and watched them, you know, take on a Surrey team that had Dan Moriarty and Amaverdi bowling for them and win. So it's kind of just basically showing how much talent's out there. So Kashif is one guy, but there's, you know, loads of players out there who are really impressing for them and kind of pushing for the chance to basically rectify this kind of gross sort of underrepresentation. Yeah.
Mm. Well, Tata has done an in-depth feature on SACA, which we published on wisdom.com this week. And there's, as he says, Kashif Ali is just one of the stories. There are loads and loads of stories, and there's obviously common themes, but individual narratives and stuff. It's definitely well worth a read. Look out for that one. I will quickly run through what's happened in the international game this week, and then we'll get onto the East Africa series. So India beat West Indies 4-1 in a T20I series. They are quite good. Obed McCoy took 6 for 17 in the second game of that series, which was West Indies' best ever T20 figures, and then 2 for 66 in the fourth, which was West Indies' most expensive T20 figures, so cricket comes at you quite fast. Over in Harare, Zimbabwe beaten Bangladesh in an ODI series, winning the first two games due to a couple of unbeaten hundreds from Sikander Raza, rescuing a side from a couple of tricky positions. His reaction to winning the first in front of a pretty healthy, pretty raucous crowd is worth seeking out as a real sort of lean back and roar after hitting the ball to the boundary. And finally, South Africa beat Ireland 2-0 in a T20I series, and New Zealand completed their Euro trip of Ireland, Scotland and the Netherlands with a blemishless record. So well done to them. Right then, let's cast our minds back to 2003. And as I said, Joe has done an excellent feature on this in the issue of Wisdom Cricket Monthly out this week. So if you enjoy this chat, pick it up. Let's start from the start with the first test, which was drawn. Graham Smith making 277 and Michael Vaughan 156. Nasser Hussain then resigns as captain, having been considering doing so in the lead-up to the series, and with Vaughan his clear successor in the form of his life. Joe, you write that Hussain didn't even tell his family that he was planning on quitting for fear of being talked out of it. And but you obviously played a key part in that series. Did you sense it coming, or did it shock you?
I know exactly what happened, because I think I gave Nasser a ride home from the game, and we were sat in the car park of the hotel, and I tried to talk him out of it. But it was clear that he was kind of done. He'd had enough, and was, you know, questioning everything about why he was doing it, and whether or not the team were kind of behind him anymore. You know, Vaughan had obviously taken over the 50 over side, and you know, he was the coming man, and I think he just realised that his time was up. So as much as I did my best to try and tell him that it was all going to be okay, he quite rightly ignored everything I said and retired between the first and second test match.
I thought it was interesting. So I was reading his book and putting this piece together. I hadn't realised that even before, because Vaughan's one day side had done really well that summer, and I think Nasser felt the pressure on him and had already volunteered to stand down, and Fletcher said, no, it's not quite the right time, but admitted that he was impressed with Vaughan's leadership. So it was all, you could sense it all closing in on him. There's a quote here which I think kind of sums it up quite well. I said, I could feel the emotions building up in me throughout the match. He's referring to the first test. I actually felt depressed and had spoken to both the ECP medical officer and our psychologist about it. People were talking about Vaughan's young brigade, and I felt deep down that I was done. I hated every second of the first test. I felt the world was against me. So these are pretty strong emotions he's feeling. It struck me, I've done a few of these pieces on the 99 New Zealand series, the Sri Lanka tour, and what always strikes me is how much Nasser put into that role and also how much it took out of him. Was that clear to see as a teammate of his, just what he was giving to it on a daily basis?
He cared so passionately about it. I mean, that was and still does. You know, you can still hear that in him when he's commentating. It was everything to him. The role, that, you know, the idea of English cricket sort of lifting itself off the bottom, being able to hold its head up, I suppose. I think he took all of that on, and some of that wasn't really his responsibility, but he felt it as the figurehead, as England captain, that it was his responsibility to make us a better team, to make us sort of respected around the world. He wanted that respect for himself, and he wanted that for the side. So, you know, it is no surprise whatsoever that he kind of felt himself. I hadn't heard the depression stuff, but I mean, you know, he wasn't the happiest bloke at the best of times, so it was difficult to tell. But clearly, you know, we're not talking about outward signs. We're talking about stuff going on, you know, behind the veneer of the eyes. So, look, he was fantastic. And I think one of the things that I don't think a lot of people appreciate, but everybody you would have played with and under Nasser would appreciate, is that his entire reason for doing the gig was to make us and everybody that played in the team better, right? You could have full stand-up row with him, swearing, yelling, throwing stuff or whatever, and within an hour it would be forgotten, and you could get on with life and get on with trying to win test matches for England. And so he was entirely the right man at the right time. And I think, you know, again, looking back at it, that his decision was as good a decision as he made about anything, you know. With all of the other stuff that he had to take on board in terms of making calls about certain players and putting his, laying his hat on people like Vaughan and Trescothick and these guys, and bringing back some of the older players who'd been discarded on the South African tour, Duncan Fletcher's first, and bringing them back because there weren't better players around, you know. The decision to step down when he did was as good a decision as he made, because he knew, he understood that he had taken the team as far as he could take it, and that there was there were younger players along with the experienced players, of which he was one, who didn't need to have their hands held all the way through every encounter, and that they were willing and able to take on their own risks, take on their own responsibilities, and kind of be a more aggressive and progressive England team. And he knew he wasn't the man to captain that, but Vaughan was. And, you know, therein lies a great leader, not only knowing what to do when you're in it, but knowing when to walk away from it.
And that came with his retirement as well, I guess, when he was, you know, played well in that test match, but recognised that Strauss was the coming man. And he probably, Hussain Bourri could have stuck around, right? And played for a while longer. I don't think there was no one like saying, demanding that he go or anything, but he sort of was like, this is the right thing for the team. So did it from that point of view. I wanted to ask about the second test and about Hussain as well, because in the piece, Joe, you said that, so Hussain dropped Graham Smith on 8 and he went on to make another double 100. And Vaughan said that he basically shouldn't have picked Hussain, that he was in no sort of fit state to play. And yet in the second of that game, he goes and kind of makes 70. And I can't work out how he can do that, basically, whether it's in spite of everything that's going on or because of it, and what kind of personality that makes him. It's kind of crazy.
Well, it sounds like Nasser's head had gone. So I guess he was just on autopilot or something like that, because I don't know if you were a witness to this, but at the end of that test match, Vaughan pulls Hussain to one side and gives him a bollocking and says that this attitude is either you're with me or you're against me, basically, and reassured him that there is a place for you in this side, but you've got to not behave like this. And Nasser said he was sort of not grateful at the time, I'm sure, but said he needed a slap around the face to kind of shake him out of that. And then from then on, things were a bit easier with him and Vaughan.
Yeah, I didn't know that had happened again. That was another thing that I wasn't party to at the time. But from that moment on, you know, Nas was back in. You know, he fielded at short leg, you know, stuck the helmet on, went from captain to boot heel, and was absolutely fine. You know, I think, I don't know what the next test match was after Lords. We got a shellacking, didn't we? And Freddie made his first 100, first home 100, that's right, in the second innings. But we fell well short. And then Tini took 10 or 11 for, I think. And then the next test would have been, what, Trent Bridge?
Yeah.
Okay, so so there you go, the conversation that Vaughan has with Nasser, and then Nasser's performance. You know, he and I both made hundreds in the first innings at Trent Bridge, and we win the test, so he was back, right?
Yeah. How immediate was Vaughan's impact? Because I think looking back now, people like to say Hussain instilled the discipline in the England team, and then Vaughan gave them the license to express themselves. But I guess at that moment, when England have, you know, they're 1-0 down, having had much the worst of the first two tests, sort of that must not have felt like a huge moment of progress, I guess, especially when the Vaughan era starts with getting thrashed by an innings. Did it feel like, was that impact immediate, or did it kind of feel like it was sort of undulating for a time, I guess?
I've got no idea. Again, it sounds like I wasn't there. But I don't know. I think we were a good team. You know, we had some really good players knocking around at that time. And we'd run into Graham Smith, who was, you know, just on a mission. Obviously, he had a big, big point to prove as captain as well. Didn't Nasser call him what's his name or something before the first, or during the toss of the first test, you know? Yeah. So, you know, he came out and wanted to prove that, you know, he was the youngest leader ever of South Africa, and wanted to prove that he was worthy of that position, and he came out like a man possessed in the first two test matches. But, you know, we drew the first one, weather wasn't great the first one. Second one at Lords, we had our moments in that test match as well. You know, it wasn't a massive pushover, and there were just enough performances in that Lords test match to sort of show, well, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of with these guys. You know, we got the right end of a good toss, batted first at Trent Bridge and put big runs on the board, and from there on in it was us. I think there was a big call in that third test at Trent Bridge, and that both Glenn Chappell and James Kirtley were both in the squad. They'd been an injury. We'd had a lot of injuries to the bowlers summer, because that's how Bickers, etc., end up playing at the end. And, you know, I was one of the senior players, so I remember, you know, I'd have a net and Duncan would come over and Vaughan would come over, you know, who do you think? And I went for Chappie. I mean, Chappie used to get me out for fun in the championship, so I never wanted to bat against him. And pretty much everybody else said the same thing, and they went with James Kirtley, who obviously took six for in the second innings. And then never played again, because they were slightly concerned that he was going to get called for throwing if he played again. I think that's how that worked out. So, you know, a little crossroads moment for Glenn Chappell's career, but also a decision that ended up paying dividends in the test match. And so we're back in the series. So, you know, Vaughan's first real chance to kind of to have made decisions that kind of that weren't hangovers from the previous captain. You win the test and we played bloody well and it was great. So away you go. And he and Duncan immediately seemed to have a really good rapport. I mean, Nasser and Duncan had a terrific rapport, but again, that there was something in that relationship between himself and Duncan that sort of clicked almost straight away. And they had again, they had their guys, and the emphasis shifted a little bit towards the younger fellas than it was from us. I mean, obviously Nasser and I had played a lot of Test match cricket together, and he sort of implicitly trusted people like myself and some of the older players. And then Vaughan would suddenly the conversations would be veering towards guys like Giles and Trescothick and things like that. They'd perhaps be first port of call rather than us. So it was a little shift, a little sort of generational shift there.
Mm. And are you on Graham Smith himself, like obviously now he's like this titan of South African cricket, and as much for his leadership as for his batting. What was your impression of him as a character? I guess were you able to have? Did you have a beer at the end of the series? Did you?
No. He very much was very gruff and kind of kept himself to himself. And that's again, it was all part of. And I think I've read stuff that he's written in the past about him putting up a veneer, putting the mask on, and trying to be, this sort of untouchable, big, scary character. And so there wasn't a great deal of warmth. And there wasn't a massive amount of that in England-South Africa contests. Going back to my first one in 98, you know, there was always a bit of niggle between certain players. One thing that you noticed again about them was that on the front foot, they were very, very tough, you know, very, very difficult to beat. But you always felt as though there were moments with his captaincy, as there had been with Hansie's, that they would kind of miss the opportunity to really bury you in a contest or make, you know, just take slightly a more conservative turn, which would give us confidence that when push came to shove, we'd be able to knock them over. Very different from playing against Australian teams, whereby you made the wrong call. You took a backward step, or you didn't press on with an advantage you had. You were going to pay for it later, and so that was something that I noticed anyway about his captaincy, that it followed a similar pattern to a lot of the other South African teams that I played against, whereby they were just a tiny bit conservative against you, which always left the door open for you to kind of come back in.
And what are the kind of things you're talking about in the dressing room when you've got a player like that who's sort of, he's batting in a kind of a weird way, basically, and you can't seem to get him out, and he's also like a new guy, so you won't have seen a huge amount of him before. Joe, in the piece, it said that James Kirtley thought the solution was just moving square leg around a little bit, which sounds too simple to be true.
But. Yeah, well, he was talking about Fletcher and Fletcher's obsession with angles and the kind of science of cricket. So I think Kirtley specifically talks about moving square leg to try and cut down some of his scoring options. But I think that was one small example of Kirtley said he really enjoyed playing under Fletcher because he thought about cricket in a similar way and he liked dissecting it. I'm sure for some players, they're like, what does that mean? Or that doesn't relate to me. But Kirtley enjoyed it. Fletcher always comes across as a really quite exceptional coach when I speak to people about his one-on-one handling of players and the things he noticed.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think there were quite a lot of disagreements actually about Graham Smith, and that might give you an indication as to why he was so successful, particularly in the first two Test matches. Because as a left-handed player, I always thought to myself, well, if the guy has got a very, very closed bat face and doesn't really want to hit the ball through the offside, you've got two options. One is you force him to try and hit the ball through the offside. So your length and your line needs to go a lot wider. But then your killer ball to him still ought to be the one that swings back in, for the simple reason that with the bat coming down closed in the first place, if the ball starts to move further towards the leg side, he's playing with like that much of the bat, you know, because it's already shut. And I think Matthew Hoggard would prove that later, you know, in the 2004 away series when he kind of kept knocking him over with the one swinging back, and Smith, rather like Hayden, was sort of like ended up flat on his face. But where there was an intense disagreement about that between the bowlers and Fletch. Fletch wanted to go the other way. Fletch wanted to go across him off stump. But if you were tight enough to off stump with the ball not really moving, he would still hit that through the leg side. So we weren't all on the same page as far as bowling to Graham Smith was concerned. And you know, and I think that was reflected very much in the returns that he had in that series.
The fourth test was another good game. Gary Kirst made an 8 hour 130. Tozz Dafoe together in the first innings.
Sound like a good game to me.
was that Headingley?
Yes, yeah.
Oh man. See, there was a thing there. Trez and I don't know if this was second innings.
Oh, was this the
bad light?
I don't
know if it was the bad light thing. Oh man. So this had happened before with Marcus and I in it, I think it might have been the mad test match where Freddie and Thorpey went nuts at was it Christchurch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a really green pitch and I think second innings Trez and I come out and we just fling the bat at it basically. We kind of like and we're going great. But then the light closes in and we have a conversation in the middle of the park. And I said, well, we're massacring at the moment. Why would we go off, you know? And he sort of went, yeah, I think you're right. Next ball cuts it straight to point out. It's not, oh, fuck. Nothing to do with the light.
Didn't see just, the fielder there. Yeah.
Nothing to do with the light. Just, you know, unlucky. Creamed it. Went straight to point out. And I swear to God, this is why what happened at Headingley. You know, I might be reading far too much into it. But similar thing is happening. We are smoking them all over the place. You know, and I can see the clouds rolling in. It looks really, really dark. And my first thought is, we're staying out here because they're toast. They run through all the bowling changes, and we just keep smashing them everywhere. And you know what it gets like at Headingley, where it's difficult to stop people from scoring. Anyway, Trez sort of sidles up to me and he goes, "Oh, what do you think?" I said, "Mate, I'm not going anywhere. This is good." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm not all that sure." Anyway, so the clouds get closer and closer, and eventually it gets dark, and the umpires come over and have a chat. And Trez is like, "Nah, look, I think we should go." And I'm like, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yeah, I think we should go." And at that point, I was a senior player in that partnership, but at that point, I'm thinking to myself, I can't persuade. If a bloke doesn't want to be out there batting, I can't persuade him to stay out there and bat, right? So I just kind of. I think I remember I put my helmet strap in my mouth and kind of walk off very slowly like this. Anyway, lo and behold, they have a bit of a chance to regroup. They have a little bit of a think about it. Trez gets out. I get out after the restart. And suddenly we're in the shit. You know, the runs stop coming and we end up losing the test match. And I remember, I don't know, I probably shouldn't have done this, but I had a bit of a go at us as a team, actually, in the dugout there after the game. Sort of made a bit of a speech about sort of Australia and about how, you know, when you're in front, you don't give back the advantage. And the inference was pretty much aimed at Marcus, which I probably shouldn't have done. But anyway, it felt to me like it was one of those things where if we really were serious about sort of moving things forward and all that kind of stuff, that's not what we should have done, not in the position that we were in anyway.
You got a battering in the press for that one as well, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, because I was a senior player. But again, you tell me, if you're out there batting and the bloke you're batting with doesn't want to bat, what are you supposed to do? You know. So either way, the responsibility was kind of mine, but it wasn't. Again, you know, it wasn't really my call. You know, everybody knows what I would have done. You know, but NASA would say, "Well, you know, you didn't care because if you got out, it would have been you'd have just blamed it on the light and not worried about it." I said, "Well, maybe, but." You know.
There was one other thing from that test. I think on the fourth evening, you and Flintoff were unbeaten at the end of day four, and it's in the piece that in Vaughan's book he describes you and him as lingering a bit too long for comfort in the hotel bar. Is that how you remember it?
Or
is it?
But again, what happened was we had our partners. Freddie wasn't married to Rachel at the time, but she and my girlfriend at the time were good mates, and they'd both come up and stayed, and we hadn't booked anywhere for dinner, and we couldn't have anywhere at the hotel, so we had a wander out into town, eventually found a table, but it was quite late. So I think we had a few drinks, and then one of the writers from the press sent a bottle of wine over to our table. Right, sent a bottle of wine over to our table, compliments of, you know, whatever. I won't say who it was. He knows who it was. And so, you know, we're kind of like, okay, well, we should probably be getting back. Anyway, we opened a bottle of wine and we drank it and then went back again. And then the very next morning, Freddie and I both got out within a blink of an eye. And the story appears in the newspapers that, you know, we were out sort of lashing it up and all that kind of stuff but with details in it from the bloke who sent us the bottle of wine. So there you go, kids. Don't trust them.
I mean, did you not sort of see the trap in a way?
No, I mean, not really. I didn't think it was a trap. We were sitting down having dinner. Yeah. And it's somebody that I know very, very well.
Also, it's rude to turn down a bottle of wine, isn't it?
Absolutely. And did it have anything to do with us getting out first thing in the morning the next day? Did it? Hell.
And the game was gone.
We were. I don't know what we put on some. Again, it was sort of another one of those evenings at Headingley where the ball just kept hitting the boundary, and you're kind of thinking, well, it's unlikely, but it could happen, given that I'd been in that position on that ground before. But then you know, as often happens with many grounds, and particularly Henley, you turn up the next day and everything's very different. You know, the ball moves around a bit, and I nick one, Freddie nicks one, and that's it, game over. Mm-hmm.
That test was also notable for the return of Martin Bicknell, playing his first test for 10 years. He reduced South Africa to 20-4 on the first morning, but was on the verge of ruling himself out of the fifth with injury before playing a key hand in what turned out to be his final test match. He talked to Joe about his part in the series.
I wanted to obviously you're taking stacks of wickets year after year for Surrey without getting a look in for quite a long time. 10 years on from your previous test, were you surprised to eventually get that call?
Shocked.
Yeah.
It just wasn't on my radar at all.
Right.
Not at all. Never even contemplated even thinking that they might turn to me. I guess they had a few injuries. And then they were looking for a horses for courses type bowler, and Headingley seemed like a decent place for me to go and bowl. I was shocked.
Can you remember how you found out? Did you get a call? Like some players I know.
Bizarrely, I was at home and I was having a nap on the sofa, and my phone rang, and I missed the call. I think it was, and it was David Graveney, and nothing. And I honestly thought he was ringing me up to ask my opinion about another bowler. So I didn't ring him back. And then about 20 minutes later, half an hour later, I had a phone call from Radio 5, I think it was, or Radio 2. Anyway, I think it was Shil Pashetti, I think it was.
Right.
And basically asking my opinion of my call-up. Can you imagine my shock?
Absolutely. Wow, what a way to find out.
Yeah.
And look, obviously, your county record over those years absolutely spoke for itself. But at 34, I think you were then, did you have any concerns about whether you could perform at that level before you got out there? Did you have any doubts in the lead-up?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think like most people in life, once you step up a level, you always got these doubts that you can go and do it again. I was slightly concerned, really, because physically I wasn't in the greatest of shape. You know, mid-season, had a few niggles and stuff, and didn't feel great. I had bowled well a couple of games before, and I got 8 wickets in the match against Notts, a wicket gift, I think, and I bowled well in that game. And it was like, and then the thoughts sort of go through your head, like, you know, damaging sort of my reputation almost. If it goes badly, people are going to say, okay, that's why you shouldn't have been picked in the last 10 years.
Sure, so, yeah.
I definitely had those thoughts going through my head, but as soon as I got up to Leeds and I had a look at the pitch, it was like, oh my God, that's perfect. So it was green, it was damp, it was just, I thought, if ever I'm going to play for England again, I mean, this is the pitch you'd want to bowl on.
And obviously made a pretty much instant impact. Got Gibbs with, your second ball?
I mean, I wasn't expecting to play, really, even then. You know,
really?
We played five seamers in that game. And I think once Armisen was declared not fit, and then basically I got the nod the day before that I would be playing. And then they said, you'll be taking the new ball. I was like, oh, okay, fair enough. And I think James Kirtley bowled the first over and got Graham Smith out, which gave us a bit of a boost. And then, second ball just came out beautifully, nicked off Herschel Gibbs, and we were off and running.
And then Callis a few overs later. That's a big one to get, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it wasn't unconventional. It was slightly unconventional. It was straight to Michael Vaughan at short mid-off. I bowled well. You know, I bowled good areas, and I'd probably built up a bit of pressure, and he thought, oh, I'm not having much more of this, so I'm going to put my bat through, and he hit it straight to Michael Vaughan and miraculously caught it.
And then in the second innings, you get Graham Smith. I wanted to speak about Smith. Obviously, he was a huge figure in that series, first captain. A strange batter in lots of ways. How challenging was he to bowl to? Did you enjoy bowling at him?
I did, because you can get any runs. So obviously, he got 2 double hundreds in that series before. So
yeah.
The talk was always about Graham Smith and how good he was. And obviously, they had a lot of very good players. Yeah, I think, you know, I got him out twice LBW, I think.
Yeah.
Both balls just swinging back in at him. I maybe hadn't faced much of that in the series so far, but clearly had a bit of an issue sort of playing around his front pad. And we exploited that.
It's obviously an interesting time for the England team as well. Vaughan had just taken over. Nasser's still in the dressing room there. I've been looking through both their books. It was obviously an emotional time for Nasser in particular, who had given so much to that job and then stepped away from it. I wondered, what was the mood like in the change room and on the pitch at that point as we're kind of going through this transition period?
You still sort of felt that there was an inevitability in that match that we were going to lose. You know, it didn't feel like there was much belief in the teams, and it was still, you know, when we got behind in the game, there was always that sort of feeling amongst the senior players that they'd seen it all before, and they were expecting to lose. But I found Michael really good as a captain. I thought he was fresh. He backed his players. He backed me, which was really important. You know, he had total belief in me over the two games I played. Which was really good, and I did enjoy his captaincy.
Then obviously that game does end in heavy defeat. Did you kind of fear that your recall might just be a one-off, that was that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I had no intention of playing another game. I thought that was it for me. And then basically, at the end of the game, it was like, okay, we'll see you at the Oval. And it was like, oh, right, okay. I bowled really well in the game. I mean, it was a really good pitch for me to bowl on. You know, I didn't have the pace that I maybe had slightly earlier in my career. So I needed sort of assistance in the pitch. I needed the ball to swing. And that happened in that match. And then I'm thinking, right, okay, next game at the Oval, which will be flat. It'll be a proper shirt front. And I think if I'm going to get exposed, this will be the game where I get exposed. So again, you know, the nagging doubt sort of creep in, and you're thinking, Christ, you know, maybe this is a step too far at my age. So I wasn't overly confident. And then on top of that, I had a bit of a hamstring niggle.
Right.
The easy thing for me to say would have been, you know, I'm not fit, because I wasn't 100% fit, and I was getting a bit of pressure from David Graveney, to make a decision. And he said, basically, you can't play in the game and then break down on the first day. So I knew I had to play the game fully fit. And I had a bit of a fitness test a couple of days before the match, and it felt okay. So I said, right, okay, I'm not going to get a better chance. This is the Oval. This is my last game. I know it's going to be my last game for England. You know, if you're going to finish, why not be at your home ground in a test match? So I declared myself fit, and obviously the game didn't go great. First day we were pretty awful. I bowled pretty poorly.
Right.
I didn't think I was having any effect in the game at all. The ball didn't do anything. It was flat. They racked up 360 for two at one point, I think they were. Yeah. And the game was done. We got booed off, I think. I think we got an awful lot of stick coming off the field that day. And at the end of that first day, I just wanted the whole thing to end. I just said, right, I'm done. You know, I don't really want to go through another 4 days of that.
Yeah.
And then overnight, I sort of had that sort of feeling of, right, okay, I didn't feel like I'd really committed in that first inning, that first day. And I thought, driving to the ground, coming into the ground, I thought, right, okay, I'm going to give it a proper go. And Michael Vaughan gave me the ball, start the innings, new ball. And I thought, right, okay, which was a surprise because he could have gone to anyone. But he gave the ball to me, and I thought, right, okay, I'm gonna really run in as hard as I can here, and I'm gonna just try and make something happen and just give it my best shot. And fortunately, I got a couple of wickets, and then we were off, and that was it. Really, we started coming back into the game. I sort of enjoyed it a bit more. We were sort of back in the game, obviously a long way behind because they got a big score. But as soon as we started batting, it was like, right, okay, if we can get slightly ahead of them here, we can put them under a bit of pressure.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. Obviously, Cho's got double 100, Thorpe got 100. And then it was like, right, and Flintoff smashed a few at the end. And we're thinking, right, okay, there's only one team that can win this now. So that gave us a massive, massive boost coming out. And I thought, right, okay, second inning, just run in and bowl, you know, full out, no regrets, and just give it your best shot. And, you know, fortunately for me, you know, it turned out really well.
You obviously didn't get another chance after playing a big part in squaring that series. Vaughan writes in his autobiography that he felt you were very unlucky not to have played more for England in the years before that, and that you were quite unfortunate that the next tours were to the subcontinent, which obviously didn't quite feed into your kind of skill set in the same way. Were you able to enjoy that South Africa series for what it was in isolation, or did it kind of leave you with some regrets that you had this now evidence that you could have performed at that level but didn't necessarily get the opportunities?
No, I think what those two games did was just confirm that I could have played at that level for much more. You know, I mean, admittedly, I was never the quickest bowler. Would I have struggled in the subcontinent? Probably, you know, but, you know, how many tours are there to the subcontinent? Mm. There were never that many. And, you know, I think I would have done well in slightly, you know, better bowling conditions. You know, with a bit of movement in the pitch or a bit of swing, I'll always find it. So I think, yeah, obviously it would have been nice to play more games, but the best thing about it was I came back and I showed people what they possibly missed, which, you know, sort of leaves me with a legacy of, you know, it sort of builds my legacy a little bit more.
Mm. Yeah.
So for that, I'm really, really grateful of those two test matches that sort of made my career in a way.
Yeah. And you mentioned you enjoyed playing under Vaughan. Obviously, this was an important series and the start of something for England. Flintoff really coming into his own and all kind of leading up to 05. Did you see Vaughan going on to achieve what he did as a captain and that team going on to become as good as they were?
Yeah, I mean, there was a really good vibe about the team. I mean, especially after the test match of the Oval when, you know, you won it and you've drawn the series against a good South African side. There was a sense of, you know, my God, yeah, we could be half decent. You know, Harmison bowled really well in that second inning as well. Jimmy Anderson was bursting on the scene. Freddie was, you know, going to be sensational. You just knew that.
Mm.
And Vaughan's a quality player. There's still a lot of very good players. So you look at it and think, like, okay, that team really should be doing a lot better than it is. And, you know, it was nice to be sort of part of that. The sort of rebirth of the side, and it was great to watch. Obviously, the way they played their cricket over the next few years.
Butch, that fifth test was basically Bazball, but 20 years ago. I mean, South Africa made nearly 500 and did it pretty quickly, and then England made more than 600 at nearly four and over. Flintoff crashed 95 nearly on a ball. Harmison claims 4 for 30 odd to skittle South Africa across day 4 and 5. Is it fair to say that this test really was the start of the Vaughan era, or could you sense it from before then?
That was one of my favourite test matches ever. I didn't particularly do anything batting wise. Bar being there at the end when we chased, knocked off 120 whatever and walked off with the stumps. It was just brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic. And again, another one of those moments where South Africa had us absolutely on toast in their first innings and then let us off. You know, I can't remember, you have to look up the scorecard, but they had a collapse, didn't they? And kind of let us back into the game a little.
They were 350 for two at one stage. That's what Bicknell says.
350 for two at the end of day one, I think. Mm. And they didn't bury us from there. I mean, you know, you could argue that 500 and whatever was burying, but it felt to us like we were still just about hanging in there. And then, of course, Thorpe on his return, and Trez plays a magnificent hand at 220. Thorpe comes out and smashes it on his game back from the wilderness.
So many great stories in that
just
game. Aren't there?
Incredible. All of it was fantastic. Everything about it. The weather was brilliant. The crowd were huge. And then Bickers' set up and dismissal of Jack Rudolph in front of his home crowd. You know, two out and one in. And we knocked them over for nothing, didn't we? In the third innings of the game, you know, they had a bit of a South Africa moment in the third innings.
And so yeah, 2-2-9, Harmison and Bicknell taking four each.
Yeah, and that was it. And it was just left for us to go and sort of strut to the end. And 2-2 felt like 2-2 after the first two Test matches. You'd have had long, long odds on that being the score at the end of that series, I think. And so, yeah, I agree with you. It's kind of, you know, suddenly there's the belief there that under the new captain and new management and with a slightly freer way of going about playing games of cricket, that we had enough really good, really talented players to be able to win matches from unlikely scenarios. Now, in NASS's day, and again, this is not to have a go at NASS, all of the chat would have been about how do we get out of this one with a draw? You know, and we may or may not have managed to do that. Probably not. But, you know, you win a game having conceded 500 back in 2003 was not something that happened in England very often.
Yeah, and we should talk about Flintoff, who was player of the series in that series. Obviously made the brilliant 140-odd and then a really quick 95 in that fifth test to sort of give him enough time. How kind of revolutionary did he feel, and how much of a breakthrough did it feel like for him? I mean, I know he'd got that 100 over the winter, but did this feel like a player who we didn't know had this in him, or was this sort of like Flintoff kind of coming good on lots of promise, or what was the feeling like around him?
It was a coming of age series for him. And again, I don't know, because I don't know that Freddie particularly sort of got on well with either Nasser or Vaughan. I don't think there was ever a sort of like a real close relationship. But under Vaughan, he kind of, he perhaps felt like he had a bit more of a free rein to go and to do what he wanted to do. And again, was surrounded by a lot of people who were good players. You know, I think if you're sort of like this superstar all rounder, but your top order doesn't ever score any runs, and your bowling attack's a bit pants, you know, apart from Richard Hadley, I suppose, you know, you could look at that and go and sort of you get buried under the weight of your own expectations, or the expectations for yourself, or the expectations that other people have of you. And then suddenly he's involved in this team, in this team environment where the batters are able to score runs, he's surrounded by other bowlers who are very, very good. And then he's able to come out there and have some fun, you know, go out there and do what he does best, which is be bloody destructive with the bat and bowl rockets with the ball. And also if South Africa had Graham Smith as this sort of the big bear, the big intimidating bloke, then we had one that was, you know, I'd take Freddie, put it this way, if I'm having to put cash on who's going to win that contest. So we also had our own, you know, our own guy that wasn't going to be pushed around by anybody. And he absolutely relished that and was allowed to do so.
Well, if you enjoyed that, make sure to pick up the new issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly out this week, with Joe's piece in that series, Not Sales Besides, including an interview with another gritty, uncompromising South Africa captain aiming to put some English noses out of joint. Joe, tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a good interview, actually. It was done by a South African writer called Luke Alfred, who got hold of Dean Elgar for us a few weeks ago. Spoke to Elgar about his rebuilding of the South African side around a campfire in one of those sort of team bonding exercises before they went to the Caribbean. They won there. They've done brilliantly since. They're top of the World Test Championship table, for those who don't follow that table religiously, i.e. everyone apart from Ben. So they're going to be a good side to play against. But Luke did well in asking him about his thoughts of New England, and Elgar's response, I thought, was quite amusing, in that he said, the New England style is quite interesting, but I don't see that there's longevity in brave cricket, because I see things evening out over time. There's often parity between England and New Zealand, and had New Zealand taken their opportunities and their catches, then things could have been very different. England would have come away with egg on their faces. So I think Elgar fancies that his South Africa side, who are going to play far more pragmatically than Ben Stokes' team, have a little bit of an opening there. And it's going to be, I'm really excited about this series. I think it's going to be fascinating to see a really strong South African attack going up against an England batting unit who are just going to play their shots. South Africa's batting is a bit weaker, I think. But that, yeah, Rabada and Norkia versus, you know, Bairstow, Stokes, Root, is going to be brilliant watching this summer. And Elgar's he's a sort of old school test skipper. So it'll be interesting to see these kind of clash of cultures, which is the theme that we've lent on for the cover of the magazine this month.
Yeah, we'll have a full preview of that series next week. But what, Joe, tell us what else is in the mag that's worth checking out?
There's a brilliant piece from Adam Collins, who was out in Sri Lanka covering the Australia series. So he was in Gaul whilst Sri Lanka were pulling off an incredible test match win, set against the backdrop of civil unrest, chaos, really. But he witnessed that the Gaul fort became a sort of battleground between Sri Lankan fans who wanted to be up there, the authorities kept trying to take them down because they didn't want them up there protesting during a televised test match. So Kolo's kind of attention was between these two things, and he writes it beautifully. He's done a lot of stuff for us over the years, but I think this might be the best piece he's done. I really enjoyed it, and you know, it's about more than cricket, which is always a good start for any cricket piece, I think. So that's definitely worth reading. Nice column from Mark Ramprakash this month on form, the vagaries of form, how it can elude you, how you can get it back. Looking at Bairstow in particular this summer, and how he's been able to kind of get back to, well, not get back, to get to new levels that we never thought he could reach. And in amongst it, we've got Andrew Miller's kind of mea culpa for coining the term Bazball, which he did on the Crick Info podcast a little while back, not knowing that it would take hold of, have a life of its own. And I don't think Key or McCullum are particularly fond of Bazball as a term. So Andrew tries to explain what it means, where it comes from, and apologises for it being everywhere as well.
Yeah. Nice. Well, make sure to pick up a copy. That's all we have time for this week. Thanks, Taha. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Joe. And if you have enjoyed listening, please leave us a nice, maybe even a 5-star review on the app of your choice. Cheers.
Podcast Network.